Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another week of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm good, Nick. How are you?
I'm all right, all right. I think I may be coming down with a bit of a flu, but hopefully not. And it is a sad day today because Sholin is joining us for the last time. He will be on the Daily Friend Show, at least for the next long while. Because he has taken up a new job opportunity, and so he's going to be leaving the IRR Daily Friend CRA fan stable. Sholin, welcome back on the show. Really good to have you here for one more time, so you can share your wisdom and enthusiasm with us.
Hey, Nick, thanks for the invitation every week that you do invite me on. I definitely appreciate it. I still don't know why you invite me, because for some reason you think I have something valuable to contribute. So I'm just grateful for that, Nick, as always.
And yeah, no, Sholin's been an absolute pleasure, and we look forward to your great exploits going forward. I'm sure we'll see you around some point. Right. With that out of the way, let us start, unfortunately, once again, by talking about electricity. I see now, interestingly, there
you
have
had
been
to do
a,
it, didn't you?
I know, I have to ruin everyone's day. You've got to start the week off on a low note so that you build into the weekend. It's like a, like you've got to ramp up to the excitement of the weekend. But anyway, so I did see an article actually this week, today I think it was, talking about how Eskom is once again bringing up this prospect of permanent stage 2 or 3 load shedding. I'm pretty sure even a few weeks ago, when the possibility of permanent stage 2 was announced, it was permanent stage 2, not permanent stage 2 and 3. But anyway, so it does look like this idea is beginning to seep into the public consciousness that there will be no respite for a good long while. So against that backdrop, we are seeing some creative solutions emerging. AfriForum have said that they are fed up with the way things are going with the electricity system. And they have come up with what they call as a three-stage plan to deal with the electricity crisis and unshackle large parts of the country from Eskom. The sort of headline part of this plan is that they say that they are looking to find investors to invest in the creation of a modular nuclear reactor, which would provide some power. So they say, they've got this multi-stage program. The first one starts off with helping out communities and businesses and such. And the second stage is looking to free municipalities from municipal or people living in smaller towns from municipal electricity. And they point to a town in the Mafube local municipality near Frankfurt, where a privately owned business utility has been managing the town's electricity supply for the last 10 years. They say this could be the model for going forward. And that they're looking to basically create their own power company. At the same time, President Ramaphosa has said that he has asked Eskom to halt the 18.65% tariff increase on electricity. So it's reported as he's asked Eskom, but when you see the actual quote from what President Ramaphosa said, it's a bit weaselly. I think we did talk about this last week where we said, you know, the president... it's kind of he said last week that the tariff increase should be implemented cautiously. I don't know what that means, but anyway, he seems to have slightly hardened his stance by saying, quote, "I have told Eskom that it should consider halting the hiking of electricity prices, especially for now while our people are struggling under high levels of load shedding. Many people are reporting that businesses are failing because of load shedding. As I've said in the address to the nation, we are short of some 6,000 megawatts. We have been working very hard. We put in place an action plan, which I announced last year in July, and the process of adding more capacity with various measures, be it renewable energy or even emergency energy, has been underway." So, Terence, I'm going to give you a double-barrel question here. Firstly, what do you make of this call by the president to halt the tariff increase? Is he actually calling for it, or is he just trying to look like he's calling for it? And two, what do you make of AfriForum's alternative electricity plan?
Well, look, on the question of the president, my concern is that his political style is effectively very cautious and a little bit weaselly here. You know, we don't he doesn't seem to like hard decisions, and this is a tough one. You know, you're paying more, and you're without power for up to 10 hours a day. It's not a great position for him as a politician to be in. But I think this is essentially what the PR types would call reputation management. Now, you know, just bear something in mind that his finance minister just about a week ago was in Davos and saying, well, we think that with these tariff increases, Eskom will have the money it needs to pay down its debt and whatever. So which is it? I think that all of us can fume and pull our hair out and flagellate ourselves about the fact that we are in this mess because of choices that were made going back to the 1990s. That things were not that capacity was not added when it was required. That that Eskom was looted, that it dispensed with skills, that then overstaffed itself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is that it's a foundational requirement for a modern society to have a power supply, and Eskom is the game in town. So you know, you're kind of stuck with trying to keep it going. So you know, maybe the hard choice is that we just have no reasonable alternative but to pony up. And if that is the case, then I think the president owes it to the electorate, to those who claims to lead, to actually say, well, this is the reality, not try to sort of massage a perception. You know, if only I can, you know, just get people to look the other way for a while, you know, they'll blow over.
Right. That's what Enoch Godongwana actually said at Davos was, you know, no, the real problem is we just haven't shown people how hard we're trying to fix this.
Yeah, you know, those of us who have my years can remember the same thing from P.W. Buerta. If only the world would just understand us. You know, sometimes the points you're trying to make just aren't good ones, you know, live with it. Dear 2023, please use lube this year. Yep, you know. There's various other things I could say, but this is a family show, so I'm not going to. You could tune into my like After 11 podcast. Now, on Afroforum, yeah. Look, I think this is a bit gimmicky, but I do like it in the sense that it's innovative. That they do have a multi-pronged strategy. And I think long term for energy, you know, sustainability, we have to get Eskom fixed up, but I think bringing private suppliers on online is intrinsic to that. Now, I know that I sometimes tend to be the odd man out, or you know, to say odd man, that might be sexist or whatever, in the institute, because I'm, you know, I buy a lot of the green argument, and I would like to see more renewables. But you know, I think that until that can deliver reliably on an industrial scale, which I believe there are big questions about, these modular nuclear reactors are something to be investigated. And I think that nuclear should be seen as part of a possible solution. The problem, of course, is that if it goes to the government, you know, just expect that lube, to be required.
So, Sherlyn, I mean, firstly, just your thoughts on the modular reactor thing, on whether you think, because I wonder whether we will see a power station, because I suspect that there's going to be a lot of efforts to derail this. It's going to be difficult to raise the money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what I really like about this is that it's a creative solution. It's like, you know, this problem, Eskom, if they started fixing the problem today, I think it's clear that the problem would not be solved for quite some time. And so even the most optimistic person has to reckon with the reality that we need an alternative solution here. So firstly, I just want your thoughts on that. And secondly, you know, the technology of these modular reactors. Now, I'm not very well read up on them, I must admit, but from the sounds of it, they kind of sound awesome. Like they could really be an innovation in the way that people look at power generation, not just in South Africa, but across the world. What do you make of all this, Shola?
Yeah, no, Nick, I definitely think that this is an incredible initiative from AfriForum's side. I mean, we are currently, a lot of the debate is around, you know what, this tariff increases that's happening with Eskom. And a lot of people are a bit misguided, I think, with having the discussion about, you know what, how much of the, by how much percentage of the increase actually happened? Is 18% too high? Is 10% maybe better? And the conversation has been misguided, and AfriForum just steps into the discussion and is actually offering an alternative plan. They understand that, you know what, we cannot be discussing Eskom. Like, Eskom does not want to be saved at this stage. And we actually need to be looking at alternative power that we want to be producing. A lot of what I've seen is that, you know,
I think we may have lost Sholin there. All right, well, while we wait for him to get back.
Look, let me let me just clarify for some of our listeners. There is no After 11 podcast, I'm afraid. it's just an in-joke that, you know, sometimes crawls out.
Yeah, the good stuff, unfortunately, always happens before the show. But anyway, okay, so let me just go to you, Terence, as a final thing while we try to get Sholin back. I kind of feel like there's going to be a lot more of this going forward, because it really feels like the government has so failed on Eskom and has so little credibility on fixing the problem that regardless of what the law says or the legislation says or how the court battles are going, a lot of people are just going to kind of get up and make a plan. Do you think that's the way we're headed?
I think that's pretty much where we are in many respects. You know, go and once again, you know, go back also to the 1980s. This isn't a particularly new South African problem that the state became soft, and people kind of had to had to sort themselves out. I mean, private security was the big one. Then private medical care sort of came in before, but it's become a veritable industry. Schooling, whatever. Fredrik von Zyl-Slobbert actually once made an interesting point that there may be people in the government who believe they have this capacity to exercise some sort of Gramscian hegemony over society, but the breadth of South Africa's civil society just kind of denies that. Now, maybe they can help, but at the end of the day, they can try and stand in the way, but they'll simply be ignored and regarded as irrelevant. And I think that... I think there would be interest that would look at this with fear and loathing, if for no other reason than it takes away opportunities for patronage, for other in other respects purely for statist reasons, you know, ideological, but. I think people are just going to go ahead and do it anyway, and you know, then let the finance minister go to divorce and find out why, you know, you shut down a two billion dollar investment because you decided that they you know shouldn't be generating their own power. Good luck.
So unfortunately, Sholin, we will have to move on to the next topic, but I'll let you start on the next ones, which is about the matric results, which the government results finally came out on Friday. We did discuss the IB results a little bit last week when they came out, I think, on Wednesday. And there was a lot of speculation that these things were going to be a disaster. You know, this was a class that had gone through from grade 10 to 12, some really disruptive years of schooling. As this one article in, I think it was Times Live, had it, they faced the COVID-19 pandemic and the associated lockdowns, the natural disasters, and load shedding. However, despite all of that, the announced pass rate was 80.1%, which I believe is even slightly up from last year, presumably reflecting students this year not being kept away from school all the time. And just to go through some of those disasters, of course, load shedding affected a whole bunch of people around the country. Around 4,000 students were load shed while they were writing exams across the country, which is quite a lot. And you don't always know whether a school has the capacity or the venues or whatever to make sure that they, you know, have liked to see when they're writing the exam. Also, KZN, horrific floods, caused a lot of damage. Lots of students' schooling was disrupted. And also, of course, the COVID-19 stuff, which saw lots of students kept away from school. Some were allowed to do online classes, but some didn't have access to that. And therefore, I don't know really what they did. I know there were catch-up programs. So, Sherlyn, I guess my first question to you is, you know, what can we really say about this 80% pass rate? Do we think it represents some sort of improvement in the quality of education? And secondly, what do you think is responsible for the class doing better than expected?
Hey, Nick. So, yeah, so obviously congratulations to those learners who actually, you know, were able to matriculate. I'm sure it wasn't an easy journey. So I think they should be applauded, those who actually passed. However, there is an issue that I know I've seen articles previously that the IRR has raised. I'm now seeing even the EFF and the DA highlight this issue as well with regards to our matric pass rate, is that although the matric pass rate is so high, it's at 80%, it does not necessarily account for students who have dropped out and, you know, throughout the academic journey since grade one. And I was even checking a recent article by News24, and it stated that it was approximately 400 learners who were meant to matriculate in 2022 who were lost during the school system. And I think that only adds to a lot of the issues that South Africa is already experiencing. And I think it's creating this ticking time bomb where we are having this large amount of students who have dropped out of the school system because of failing public education, whatever the case may be, these issues that you mentioned, Nick, like load shedding, COVID-19, whatever the crisis might have been. And all of these things have compounded and it's creating this ticking time bomb where we have this large growing number of unemployed, unskilled youth, and it is only growing. And eventually I fear that this frustration and anger will explode in South Africa, and the consequences, I mean, that is anyone's guess what is likely to occur, Nick.
So there's a stat that I think it may have originated with the IRR, but I've seen it being used by politicians and stuff now, which is just as you said, Sherlyn, you know, there's these 400,000 kids who drop out between grade 1 and grade 12. But then when you look at one of the skills that's most important for one of the subjects that's most important as a benchmark for showing how well your education went, which is maths, something that South Africa has particularly struggled in, you have a really, really small group of students who, I think it's only 5% of learners who start grade 1 will finish matric with 50% in maths, which is pretty crazy, because I think that suggests that, you know, for a lot of kids, you're kind of just being pushed through the system. It feels sometimes, I think, our education system, like it's more, you know, child warehousing and feeding scheme rather than it is actual education. Terence, your thoughts?
Yeah, that you can talk about this tragedy for hours and hours and hours. And the sad thing about it is this is not about money. South Africa actually spends quite respectably on education. There are issues with teacher professionalism. But I think, you know, I spent some years teaching English as a second language in Asia. And something that I believe is a major contributor to our problem is that so many kids are being instructed in a language in which they are not fully competent. I don't have an easy answer to how you deal with that, but you know, I challenge people, even who, you know, speak second languages fairly fluently, to imagine what it would be like to try and, you know, write a history essay. You know, that, and you know, you add to that the issues of family breakdown, you know, dysfunctional communities. There have been some interesting experiences. I think one in the town of Kutsong some years ago, where they took students from very poor, deprived backgrounds, put them in kind of boarding establishments, and found that their performance improved. But yeah, you know, we have an economy that demands high level skills. We need more entrepreneurs. We need more people able to take up skilled artisanal work. That's something else that's really failed. You know, we don't have the apprenticeship system like we used to. Instead, people are pushed through the CETAs, which I understand are extremely difficult to access your funding, your accreditation, etc. Yeah, it's a great concern, indeed.
So, Sherlyn, very briefly going through the stats by province, most of this kind of makes some sort of sense, right? The second place is Gauteng with 84.4%, KZN with 83% pass rate, Western Cape with 81%. So I'm not 100% sure about that. I wonder if the Western Cape shouldn't be a little bit higher there. But anyway, and then you've got provinces like Northern Cape and Limpopo at the bottom with 74% for the Northern Cape and 72% for the Limpopo. What really sticks out to me, though, in the provincial stats is that the Free State apparently had an 88.5% pass rate, which is even an increase from last year, which was already, I think, 86%, or I think it was the highest again. What do you attribute that to?
Sure. I would definitely say, and I'm speaking under correction right now, but I definitely think that there's definitely some sort of trend that we would likely to see, that the higher the dropout rate, the higher the pass rate. I definitely think that's definitely the case, especially considering that a province such as Free State, that we know that there tends to be a lot of dysfunctionality happening with regards to the government in that region. For them to be outperforming a province like the Western Cape, yeah, I might be a bit biased in that comment, but yeah, I don't really think that's possible, Nick.
Yeah, and I find it odd too. Anyway, okay, so last thing, you know, this is always the thing that I think we need to punt whenever we talk about education, is that of education vouchers. So for those who aren't familiar, very briefly, it's an idea where instead of the government just giving money to the schools, it gives vouchers to each parent, which is the amount of money it would have spent on the child's education anyway. And then it says to the parent, spend it wherever you want at whatever school you want. It can be a sort of a state school, it can be a private school, whatever. And then you give parents a lot of opportunities to choose where their kids are going to go to school. And if their kids aren't doing well in one school, well, they can take them up and put them in another one. They're not sort of constrained by the current system, which is all about very kind of top down, or you've got to make sure that we have kids in the area and you go to school in the area you are. And then people fight for the few places in the good schools, and it's all just a bit of a mess. And the private sector is mostly reserved for the elite rather than for the poor. Terrence, do you have any final thoughts?
Look, I think that there is a great deal of merit to that, but I think that at the same time, as in many things, a functioning state system is going to be what people depend on, because it simply has the reach that that even aggressive private sector provision would struggle to fill up. So, you know, while I think that expanding those opportunities is great, and I think it should happen, and I'm broadly a proponent of vouchers, there's no substitute for actually getting those existing systems functioning. You know, and a piece of good news that you know is also reflected pretty much every year. There are stories about this where schools in very poor communities manage to perform well. So you know, I think that there are lessons, and I think often, you know, it comes down to competent management, to committed staff, to kids who have been imbued with a desire to succeed. You know, that we can do more with the basket of resources that we have.
No, that's for sure. All right, let us move on to our last topic for today, and that is a commemoration event for the Battle of East Lanawanna. The battle was fought in 1879 and became famous around the world because a Zulu army managed to defeat at least half of a British force that had been sent to invade Zululand in order to incorporate it into a confederation of South Africa. The battle's been immortalized in films like, its sister battles, Rorke's Drift, which was immortalized in the film, I think the 60s film Zulu, and then East Lanawanna itself in the film Zulu Rising. It's captured the hearts of Zulu Dawn, sorry. It's captured the hearts of many sort of amateur historians around the world, and it provides an endless source of sort of pride to Zulu South Africans and fascination to particularly overseas tourists, Brits, because it's a sort of classic underdog story, right? The Zulus, without the benefit of a lot of the more modern technology, managed to defeat this British force. And so it's always had a bit of a place in politics and history and identity. The commemorations were the 144th. They were held yesterday, which was the anniversary of the battle. And there was a reenactment. A small group of people reenacted the events of the day. Interestingly, as part of the ceremony, there were people, because East Lanawanna has religious significance to some of the local people in that area. The Zulu King was in attendance, as well as Jacob Zuma, actually. There were praises to a local goddess. And the thing that people were asking for was an end to drought and killings in KZN. I think the second one there is particularly interesting, sort of sign of our times, of how, what's on top of people's minds in that part of the world. It also had Mangosuthu Buthelezi, former leader of the IFP, in attendance as well. So Terence, you're an avid sort of history fellow, as am I. I feel like this is something that we do get some tourism benefit out of, but we really could be getting a lot more. What's your thoughts on the commemoration of this battle?
It's an iconic thing. It showed, which I think was particularly significant in the to the British Victorian public, that native armies, as they would have been called, weren't just mobs of people who ran at you with blunt instruments. There was a very definite discipline in the way that the Zulu army was organized, the way that it advanced. I see someone lived in NDE. Well, that's where I grew up, Dundee. So I'm well familiar with both South Lanawanna and Rorke's Drift. I think that one might take away from this is that it exposes a lot of the sort of complexities of the time. It's often not mentioned just how many how much of the camp at St. Lawana was composed of British auxiliary troops. The mounted,
I think in the recreation they did include such
That's good. And also the one of the most disciplined actions fought by the British Army was by horsemen of the Edendale contingent, mostly black Christians who lived in the Edendale Valley outside Pietermaritzburg, and had sort of been absorbed into colonial society on a subordinate basis. But there were long-standing grievances with the Zulus, and they withdrew in very good order before being overrun and killed. In that movie Zulu, actually, there's a remark, probably fictionalized, but I think which goes to this, where Ardendorf, who was the only man to have fought in both, or the only man on the British side to have fought in both actions, mentioned that, they wiped out the British garrison and also, these native levies. And Michael Caine says, oh, well, damn, the levies, more cowardly blacks. And he says, well, they fought on your side, and who do you think's coming to destroy your little outfit, the Grenadier Guards? What I would say is, take away from this, you know, some of the best and the worst of our history, some of the heroism and the tragedy. And you know, remember that this is the kind of thing that binds South Africa, both in history, but also in the hearts of people around the world. It's a kind of wonderful adventure story. If that's not insensitive. And my view is there were, you know, brave and honorable men fought and died on both sides. And, you know, they neither should be forgotten.
Sean, very briefly, I don't know how familiar you are with East Lantwana. I don't know whether it's taught in high school, generally speaking. But any thoughts you have to add before we close up for today?
Yeah. A last comment I'd probably have is that before this, I did not know about this story, but I'm definitely going to be researching more about it because I really found it interesting. And I think more of it should occur because I think a lot of times we have this very, best I say, wayward idea of what history is actually like, especially as a young person. And I think that this actually displays that, you know, we have this idea of like colonialism, all of these things that occur that's so horrific, and that natives were these victims, you know, who just couldn't do anything against whatever settlers arrived. And I think this is one of those stories where it's actually displayed. But you know what? These people actually had strategy. These natives, one of the most important tribes in South Africa, they actually put up quite the fight, and I really think that is a good idea to actually have, especially to break down.
No deal.
Damn. Okay, I assume he was going to say breakdown some of our preconceptions of how our history works, and I completely agree with that sentiment. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to the show today. We hope that you found it interesting. Sholin, thank you for coming on all these episodes. We're going to miss you, but I'm sure you're going to be having a good time at your new work ventures.
Fight the good fight.
Indeed. And with that, all I can say is cheerio and have a good afternoon.